Now we come to the lecture of the 1st of June, 1908. Rudolf Steiner starts by saying it was really a daring domain upon which we have entered last time, insofar as we have directed our attention upon certain beings which exist within our reality as spiritual beings, which, however, in a certain way have fallen out of the regular course of evolution, and whose actual significance precisely consists in the fact that they have in a certain way fallen out of the course of evolution. We have kept in mind the elementary beings who, precisely through the place which they take in the cosmos, will play a very significant role in our spiritual evolution in the not too distant future. We have seen how such elementary beings form themselves insofar as they are, as it were, irregular, cut-off portions of group souls. We only indeed have to remind ourselves that we, at what we said at the end of the last lecture, and we will immediately have placed before our spiritual eye such elementary creations. We have indeed pointed to one of the last formed of these types of elementary beings. We have pointed to the fact how each animal form, or when we speak in a coarse sense, corresponds to a totality of equally configured animal soul, animal beings. This totality corresponds to a group soul. We have said that these group souls, as it were, play in the astral world the same role which our human soul, insofar as it is endowed with an ego, and so the same place, the same role which our human soul plays in the physical world. Actually, the human ego is a kind of group ego which has descended from the astral plane to the physical plane. And through that, it has become, this group ego has become an individual ego. The animal egos today are still in a regular way upon the astral plane. And what we have as a single animal individuals here on the physical plane has upon the physical plane only the physical body, ether body, and astral body, and the ego it possesses in the astral world, but in such a way that similarly formed animals, as it were, are the members of this group ego, of this group ego of this animal species. We're able, we can represent to ourselves how that which one calls birth and death in the human life, that does not have, birth and death in the human life does not have the same significance for animals. Because when a single animal dies, so the group soul or the group ego remains living, although the single animal dies. It is precisely so as, if we assume it were possible, that man had lost a hand and possessed the capacity to again deposit another hand, replace it by another hand. His ego would not say, I have died because I've lost my hand, but it would feel how it has renewed a member. So there renews the group ego of the lions, renews for itself another member when a single individual lion dies and is replaced by another lion. So we are able to understand that birth and soul, birth and death for the group soul of the animal does not at all have the significance as it has for human beings of the present evolutionary cycle. The group soul of the animal experiences transformations, metamorphoses. It knows, for example, the cutting off of individual animals and then the stretching out of new animals into the physical world to replace the loss of these members. There's a renewal process. Now, we have said that there exist certain animal forms who go far on, who proceed very far in this cutting off process, that they are no longer able, everything which they send down to the physical plane, to again return it back to the astral plane. Because with a dying animal, that which falls away must go completely into the surrounding world. Where, on the other hand, that which through spirits and through souls the animal must stream back into the group soul in order then again to become stretch itself forward and to grow into a new individual animal. Now, there are certain animal forms who are not able to send back completely all this into the group soul, and that which is left over can be cut away, torn away from the group soul, and then leads a separated existence as elementary beings. And since our evolution has passed through the different forms and stages, and there our evolution has passed through different forms and stages, and upon every stage and each stage there have been cut off, separated, such elementary beings, you can therefore very well understand that we have around us a large number of kinds of elementary beings in that which we designate the supersensible world which surrounds us. When, for example, the intellectual, clever person says, here they speak of elementary beings, which they call sylphs, and also lemures. There are no such things. So you give him the answer, you must say, you do not see these things because you have closed up for yourself the very organs which would enable you to bring to yourself a recognition of the existence of these beings. But you ask the bees, or with other words, ask the soul of the beehive. They cannot be hidden from themselves the existence of sylph or lemures, because the elementary beings which we designated as sylphs or lemures, they have a special definite place, namely there where you have a certain contact of the animal kingdom with the plant kingdom. And also there, not always when you have the contact with the animal kingdom and the plant kingdom, but on special places where this contact occurs under certain relationships. Now, when the ox eats grass, to be sure, there occurs a contact of the animal kingdom with the plant kingdom. But that is, so to say, a very regular prosaic contact which lies completely in the regular process of evolution, regular course of evolution. But at a quite other leaf of world evolution, there exists that contact which occurs between bees and the blossom. And indeed, because bees and blossoms in their organization are far more separated from each other and subsequently come together again. Because with the contact of the bees and the blossom, there developed a quite wonderful force. It belongs, if one wants to use this expression, because for these subtle things we have so little adapted expression, you can say this belongs to the most interesting observation of the spiritual supersensible worlds, that remarkable auric sheath which always occurs when a bee or some other such insect sucks at a blossom. The characteristic special type of experience which the bee has when it sucks on the blossom is not in the chewing instruments of the bee, or it's not present in the body of the bee, but it arises as an exchange of taste between the bee and the blossom, and that spreads out something like a small etheric aura. Every time when the little bee sucks, it produces such a small etheric aura. And always when something like that arises in the supersensible world, there comes that associates with it such beings which need such things. They are attracted to that because they find, if we want to express it very coarsely, there they find their nutrition. Beings find their nutrition in this small aura which is produced in the contact of the little bee as it sucks at the blossom. I have already in another occasion told you that the question ought not to deal with us. We should not concern ourselves with the question as from where do all these beings come of which I'm speaking about. Where there is an opportunity given for such beings, they're always there. If a man, for example, spreads out of himself evil, bad feelings, then these evil, bad feelings are also something which lives around him. And these evil, bad feelings attract to themselves beings who are already there, but are just waiting whenever any kind of physical being offers them their food. I have compared that once with the comparison that in a pure room there are no flies. However, if you have all sorts of food residues in the room, so the flies are there. So it is with these supersensible beings. All you need to do is give them the appropriate food. The little bee which sucks at the blossom, that spreads out a small etheric aura. And they're attracted to that such beings. In particular, when somewhere at a tree a whole swarm of bees settles and then goes away, so to say, with the taste perception in the body which was there, then this whole swarm of bees is enclosed in this etheric aura, but also completely permeated by these spiritual beings which one calls sylphs or lemures. Particularly in such border domains where, so to say, different kingdoms come into contact with each other, are these beings there, and they really play a role. They are particularly only then there when this depicted fine etheric aura arises. They're not only there when this etheric aura arises, but also, I might say, they satisfy themselves not merely, but they have also a hunger, and they bring the hunger to expression through the fact that they direct the animals towards the appropriate places. These beings experience hunger, and they bring their hunger to expression by leading the bees towards the blossom. You can say, in a certain way, they're the leaders of the bees. So we see that such beings which have given up their connection with other worlds which they formerly were united, through that they play a remarkable role. They've exchanged a remarkable role. He's referring to the fact, I'm sure, that these elementary beings have cut themselves off from the group soul, and so they go, cut themselves off from that world, and then they exchange that for another role. They have become beings who can very well be used in other worlds. To be sure, if they are so utilized, a kind of organization is instituted that they are subject to higher beings. You recall that I told you at the beginning of today's lecture that human knowledge in the very not too far distant future will very well have to take a notice of the existence of these beings. There will be, in the not too all distant future, science will take a very remarkable course. Science more and more, so to say, will become more and more sense physical and will restrict itself purely to the description of external physical sense facts. Science will limit itself to the coarse material aspects, even if today there still exists a remarkable period of transition. There indeed exists in a time, there did exist recently a time of the strongly coarse materialism in science. That's not very far behind us. But this materialism will soon have to change its attitude. We see there a quite number of abstract theories arise in which, in a very sort of tentative and bashful way, they're beginning to point to the existence of something of a supersensible nature. The course of events, however, and the power of external sense facts will precisely throw over these remarkable, fantastic theories, and as a result of the unsatisfying nature of physical science, and one day the intellectuals will find themselves in a very remarkable situation in reference to these theories. Everything there which is speculated out about the existence of an all-being, an all-in-soulness of this or those worlds, all these speculations will be thrown over, and people will have nothing further in their hand other than pure physical sense facts on the domains of geology, biology, and astronomy. I understand Rudolf Steiner is saying that today we had first in the past a strong materialism. Now we're in there's a very transition period when people are talking and speculating about something of a supersensible nature in a very abstract way. But this will pass away and people will come back to focus completely upon sense physical aspects as a result of new researches. That's what he's saying to me. Now Rudolf Steiner continues. Then, however, there'll come the time where mankind, in a great number of its representatives, will become ripe enough to recognize the supersensible worlds of which today is spoken about in the spiritual, scientific, or theosophical world conception. Such a phenomenon as the life of the bees in connection with that which one can know out of the supersensible worlds, that offers a wonderful answer upon the great riddle of existence. And from still another side, are these things of a very great importance. It will be for the mankind increasingly inessential that mankind begin to understand the nature of group souls, because the essential being of these group souls, to recognize the beingness, the existence of these group souls, will also play a great role in the purely external development of mankind. If we, in the course of times, in the course of go back thousands and thousands of years, so we find human beings themselves still belonging to a group soul. In the human development upon the earth, there has been a evolution from the group soul aspect to the individual soul. More and more man advances so that this ego-gifted soul descends down into the physical. And in the physical, it has the opportunity of becoming individual. We are able to consider different stages in mankind's development. Then we shall see how the group soul gradually individualizes itself. If we go back, for example, into the time of the first third of the Atlantean cultural development, there the life of the human being was quite different. In the bodies in which we at that time were incorporated, embodied, their experience, our souls experienced in these bodies quite other processes. One process, which indeed in the life of the human being, of the human being, the single human being, as well as man as a social individual, there's one of these processes which plays a role. We can focus in our mind, which since that particular time has passed through a great change, namely the interaction of waking and sleeping. We have a Teutonic style, a whole paragraph which he could have said in one simple sentence. This paragraph could be condensed in one sentence by saying that man in the first third of the Atlantean cultural development had a different experience between waking and sleeping than he has today. But he made a whole paragraph out of that sentence. Okay. Now again, he continues, back to the text, he says, in the ancient Atlantean times, you would not have been able to experience the same interchange of waking and sleeping. Now he asks the question, what is then the characteristic difference in comparison with the present human beings? When the physical and the ether body lie in the bed, the astral body and the ego lift themselves out of the physical and etheric, then that particular quality which we call today consciousness, which our today's consciousness is, that sinks down into an indefinite darkness. In the morning, when the astral body again draws into the astral body with the ego again draws into the physical body and the ether body, then the astral body and the ego utilize the physical organs and the consciousness lightens up, okay? This existence from daily waking in consciousness, nightly sleeping in unconsciousness, was earlier not present. It was much more so, if we can utilize the expression, that man, when it was day, and he dived down into his body to the extent which it was the custom for him to dive down into his body at that time, in no way saw the external physical beings and things in such borders as we see them today, but he saw external objects with indefinite swimming out contours towards the outside. Just as when, for example, you go to a fog, and in a fog, you have a lantern in a fog, and surrounding in a foggy evening, you have a cloudy aura surrounding a lantern. That's how people at that time, during their daytime consciousness, saw external objects without fine contours. So it was for mankind of that time with all things. They were surrounded by a nebulous and a cloudy aura. And if that was the condition in day, then the question is, what was the condition during the night? When man during the night went out of his physical body and ether body, there did not arrive at absolute unconsciousness. All there was only another kind of consciousness. It wasn't unconsciousness, but another kind of consciousness. At that time, man still perceived spiritual processes and spiritual beings around himself. Not as exactly as in real clairvoyance, but there was present a last residue of the ancient clairvoyance. During the day, there was a world with feshvomena, nebulous borders, contours. That's how man lived during the day. In the night, he lived among spiritual beings which were around him just as objects were around him during the day. So there was not such a strong differentiation between day and night. And that which is contained in sagas and myths are not things of some arbitrary folk fantasy, but they are memories of experiences which the ancient human being had in his consciousness condition of that time of the supersensible world. Votan or Zeus or other supersensible divine spiritual beings which are recognized by this or that peoples are not the speculations of some folk fantasy which you can have asserted at the green tish of a modern intellectual. The person who merely asserts that has really never become absolutely familiar with the essential nature of the folk fantasy. It didn't occur to the people merely to personify things in that way in which is being attributed to them by these intellectuals. These were the result of actual experiences of ancient times, not speculated fantasy. Votan and Thor were beings with which man so went around as he today goes around with his fellow human beings. And the myths and the sagas are memories of the times of the ancient clairvoyance. However, we must be clear about the fact that with this living into the spiritual supersensible worlds, there was something else connected with it. Man felt himself in these worlds not as an individual being. He felt himself as a member of spiritual beings. He belonged, so to say, to higher spiritual beings as the hand belongs to us. That small feeling of individuality which man already had at that time, he received when he dived down into his physical body, when, so to say, for a short time, he emancipated himself from the ruling of these spiritual divine beings. And that was the beginning of his feeling of individuality. That was in a time in which man was absolutely clear about the fact that he had a group soul. He found himself, he felt himself diving down into the group soul when he distanced himself from his physical body and entered into his supersensible consciousness. That was an ancient period in which there was present in the human being with a strong, with an immense powerful strength, the consciousness of belonging to a group soul, to a group ego. Now, let us consider the second stage of human development. We're just omitting intermediate stages. Let's consider the second stage. A second stage which is pointed to in the history of the patriarchs of the Old Testament. What was there at the base of that, we have already mentioned. We have already given you the reasons why the patriarchs Adam and Noah, etc., were considered to have such a long life. They had such a long life because the memory of human beings at that time was quite different from the present human memory. The memory of the present day human beings has become much more individual. He remembers what he himself experienced since his birth. In many cases, only back to a much longer period after he was born, a later period. So it was not in ancient times. memory of the present-day human beings has become much more individual. He remembers what he himself experienced since his birth, in many cases only back to a much longer period after he was born, a later period. So it was not in ancient times. At those times, there were things which the father experienced between birth and death, things which was experienced by their father between birth and death, experience which were experienced by their grandfather, things that were experienced by their great-grandfather. These experiences of their ancestors were just as a part of the individual experience of memory as today your own experiences between birth and death are your experiences. So special, so strange it might appear for present-day man, it nevertheless is true that there were times in which such a memory was of such a nature that expanded itself through the whole blood relationship, that superseded, went far beyond the individual memory. And when we ask ourselves, what are the external signs for the fact that such a memory did once exist? So you have in the Old Testament such names as Noah and Adam. And with the names of Noah and Adam, it is not meant to refer to single individuals between birth and death. Man who simply has a memory of his present life between birth and death, that sort of person you give an individual name to. But earlier on, the giving of names were expanded so the memory reached far out into the generations, as far as going through the blood that flows through the generations. Adam is nothing else other than a name which lasted so long as the memories of Adam lasted. The person who doesn't know that the name giving in an earlier time was quite different from today can't understand the essential nature of these things. In those ancient times, there was a quite different mediated fundamental consciousness. Just imagine an ancestor had two children. Each one of these two knew the next generations and so on. Just think again, the ancestor had two children. And each one of these two children furthermore had two more children. Each one of these two more children. And the next generation had again two more and so on and so on. With all these people, the memory reached back to this single ancestor, and they felt themselves united in that memory, which, so to say, converged back to a point of the ancient ancestor. The people of the Old Testament brought this condition to expression in so far as they said, and this was valid for each member of the Old Testament, who said, I and the father Abraham are one. There, the single human being felt himself carried in the consciousness of the group soul in the father Abraham. Now, the consciousness which Christ gave to mankind goes beyond that, supersedes that. The ego is connected in his consciousness directly with the spiritual world. And that comes to the expression in the sentence, before Abraham was, there was the ego, the I, or the I am. I am, the I am was before Abraham was. There comes the impulse of stimulating the I am-ness completely into the single individual. So we see a second stage of mankind's development, the group soul time, which finds its expression in the blood generation in the blood relationship of the generation. A folk which has developed that in particularly can place special value on emphasizing the fact that, as a people, we have a common people group soul. And this was absolutely the case for the people of the Old Testament. Hence, the conservatives within this Old Testament were battling against the emphasis of the I am of the individual ego. The person who reads the John Gospel can, with his very hands, seize on to this, grasp this idea. All you need to do is to read the story of the conversation that Jesus had with the Samaritan woman at the spring. There is expressly pointed out to the fact that Christ Jesus also goes to those who are not blood related, who are not connected through blood relationship. Just read how it is especially pointed out to the fact, and it says in the sentence, since the Jews had no association with the Samaritans. In quotation. If you take that and meditatively think upon that sentence, then you can see how from that point onwards, mankind has advanced from the group soul to the individual soul. History, as it is pursued today, is pursued in a very external way. History today is in many cases a fable convenue, a convenient fable, which is written purely out of documents. Just imagine if certain documents were lost, then the whole history would have been different. However, the person who really knows things in their spiritual reality, that person doesn't need any documents. Doesn't matter what documents, external documents are lost. He can still see the true story which is written in the Akashic Chronicle and which cannot be lost. However, it's very difficult to read in the Akashic Chronicle because in some cases the external documents can even be a hindrance for reading in the spiritual Akashic record. However, we are able to see how even in the times which are quite close to ours, that development from the group soul to the individual soul has occurred. The person who is able to observe history in a spiritual way will be able to recognize in the early Middle Ages a very important turning point of time. Before that point of time, the human being, even if externally was, he was embedded in some sort of groups, in a much higher degree than today's man would ever dream. In the early times of the Middle Ages, man received his significance and his validity also in relationship to his work position. He got that from his relationships and other connections, his family, etc. It was a very obvious thing that the son did the same thing which the father did. Then there came the time of the great discoveries and the great voyages and the inventions and the discoveries. The world continuously places more demands on the purely personal abilities of the human being, and more man is torn out of the old connections. The expression of that we can see in the whole of the Middle Ages in the establishment of the cities, which in the same sort of type began to establish themselves all over Europe. Cities were being founded. Today we can still see how the cities which are formed according to this type differentiate themselves from those which have been established upon other foundations. In the middle of the Middle Ages, you see again such a progress from the group soul to the individual soul. When we look into the future, then we must say to ourselves, more and more man emancipates himself from all the group soul qualities. He more and more individualizes himself. When you're able to look back to earlier phases of development of mankind, so you'll be able to see that those cultures, which, for example, the Egyptian cultures and the Roman cultures, you could say, are poured out of the same tap. Today, there exists such a culture which is poured out of the same tap, only in a very small degree. Mankind has descended down to the point where not only habits and customs have become more individual, but even opinions have become more individual. There are even people among ourselves today which consider it as a high ideal that each person should have his own religion. They're shaped before many people the idea that at one time there must be a time must come in the future in which there will be able to be so many religions and so many truths as there are so many people. Now this development mankind will not take. They would, however, take it if the impulse will be continued further, which proceeds out of materialism. And that would lead to a disharmony, to an actual splitting up of human beings into single individuals who have their own opinions and their own truths. Such a development, mankind will, to be sure, will not be taken if only mankind will take up such a spiritual movement as is spiritual science. Because what would enter? What would occur? The great truth, the great law, would live itself out, that the individual truths which are found in an innermost way at the same time will become universally valid. If spiritual science begins really to enter into mankind's culture, then people will indeed find their individual truths. But in going down into their deep spiritual layer, those individual truths will at the same time be truths of a universal validity. That's if spiritual science will take hold. I've often pointed out to you the fact that today you have a universal agreement only in the realm of mathematical truths. No one can really say that a mathematical truth comes from external experience. But mathematical truths can be, all people can inwardly realize the universal validity of mathematical truths. They realize this not through an external experience, but through an inner realization. Rudolf Steiner here gives the well-known way in which you can take two parallel lines, and you can prove that a triangle consists, the sums of the angles, the three angles of a triangle equal 180 degrees. You can prove it in your own mind without going outside by drawing a line parallel to the base, and you all know how that's done. I'm not going to do it for you. He draws it in the diagram and you know it. This is a truth that you do not find by induction, but by deduction. The most trivial of all truths, the arithmetical truths, the geometrical truths, can be found in your own inner being, and people cannot argue about them. About those, you have a universal agreement, because man has advanced today so far that his consciousness is able to realize into these things. You do not get any agreement whenever the pure truth has been clouded over by passions or by sympathy and an antipathy. Now there will come a time, even though this time may lie in the not too distant future, where mankind more and more will be taken, seized hold of by the existence, the cognition of the inner truth world. Then, in spite of all individuality, in spite of that, the truth, the same truth, will be found in every single person. More and more domains will be great, taken over by this form of truth, and more peace will therefore come into mankind when the truth is grasped in such a way. Man has grown out of the group soul aspect. More and more, man emancipates himself from the group soul aspect. When we observe the groups instead of the souls, so we have family connections, tribal connections, folk connections, and finally, people belonging together in races. The race corresponds to a group soul. All these group connections of a primal mankind are such out of which man grows out of. And the more and more we progress forward, the more and more does the concept of race lose its significance. Today we stand in a time of transition, and gradually that which constitutes race will be completely disappeared and will appear in a quite another application. Human beings who, again, will be able to grasp the spiritual truths as we have characterized them, will, through a free will, be drawn together. These are the connections of the future later time. The connections of the earlier times were so that man were automatically born into these connections. Man was born into his nation, into his race. But later on, in the future, we will live in connections in which the human being himself will make his own connections, insofar as people will group themselves into groups which will stand under the complete preservation of their freedom and their individuality. The fact of seeing into this is a necessary for correct knowledge of the reason for the existence of such a thing as the Theosophical Society. Through the fact that human beings in a free will way will permit their feelings to radiate together, there will again form itself something of an emancipated mankind. The emancipated man has his individual soul. That individual soul is never lost to him when once he has acquired it. However, through the fact that human beings in a free will connection find themselves together, they will group themselves round a middle point. The feelings which will so stream together towards a middle point, they will then again give occasion for beings to form which work as a kind of group soul. But however, a group soul meant in a quite different sense as the ancient group souls. All the earlier group souls were beings which made the human beings unfree. These new beings, however, these new group soul beings are compatible with the complete freedom and individuality of the human being. And it will remain in the, belie in the souls of human beings themselves if they, to the highest degree, can give such higher souls an opportunity to descend down to human being. It's up to the human being himself will he provide an opportunity for such higher beings to descend to the human beings or not? The more the human beings will split themselves apart, the less these elevated souls will be able to descend down into the domain of man. But the more that associations are built, and the more when you have the community feeling existing, developed, with complete freedom, the more will elevated beings be able to descend to the human being, and all the more will the Earth planet become spiritualized. So we see that the human being, if he has in the main a concept of the development of the future, he must have an understanding of the character of group soulness, because otherwise it could happen that an individual soul, if it will emancipate itself too much upon the earth and individualize itself, it won't be able to find the attachment to a, and it will miss the attachment to this new group soul, and itself will become an elementary being. If individuals do not realize the new type of group soulness which will form in the future, a group soulness based upon the individualization of the individual, upon his feeling of individuality, based upon the fact of all social truths will be clearly seen into as mathematical truths, then there will arise this new unity, a new type of unity, a new type of group soulness, which people will find attachment to. But if people do not find attachment to it, then they will cut themselves off from this new type of group soulness, and they will produce a elementary beings, just as elementary beings occurred from the cutting off from the ancient animal, from the group soul of animals, you had elementary beings were formed. So new type of elementary beings will be formed from human beings who cut themselves off from the new group soulness. And these elementary beings of a very quite horrible kind will arise. Whereas the earlier elementary beings who have arisen out of the earlier kingdoms are very useful for the ordering of nature. These human-produced elementary beings will not at all have that quality of usefulness. We have pointed to the fact that in certain border domains, such cut-off beings arise, and they arise also on the border in the transition from the group soul aspect to the free group connections through groups. The new group soul are connections of an aesthetic, moral, and intellectual nature. The aesthetic, moral, intellectual qualities are combining people together into the new group soul and not physical heredity stuff. Wherever you have such aesthetic, moral, intellectual connections, you will have such group beings there. Now, if your group, Sonny continues, now if you're able to observe certain places, for example, springs, where you have underneath a stone and you have moss growing over it, so you have a kind of wall formed between the plant and the stone, and then you have water trickling over it, that is also necessary, then you will see that you will, what one calls, nymphs and undines, something there which shows itself with special strength. Nymph and undines. There, where metals and the other earth kingdom meet together, there exist quite bundles of such beings, which one calls gnomes. A fourth kind are the salamanders. They are, so to say, the most recent race in the series of these whole elementary beings. Nevertheless, they are in a manifold way present. They are, on the greatest part, beings who thank their existence for a cutting-off process out of the animal group souls. Such beings also are looking for opportunity to find nutrition and food, and they find it particularly there, where the human kingdom, in a quite not normal, completely normal way, come into connection with the animal kingdom. The person who thinks about such things, knows about such things, he knows that elementary beings, and really good types of elementary beings, develop themselves as a result of that familiar connection between the rider and his horse. In particular, they form themselves through such gemut connections, through that special soul connection between certain human beings and animal groups. They develop certain feelings, certain thoughts, certain soul impulses, which provide very good food for such salamander-type elementary beings. That one can also specially notice in the connection with the shepherd with his flock of sheep. In the main, between shepherds who live together with their animals, in the special feelings which develop themselves through the intimacies between man and animal, certain types of salamander elementary beings find their nutrition, and they find their presence there where they can find those feelings. These are also really clever beings, which have a thoroughly natural wisdom. There develops itself by the shepherd capacities which are whispered into the human being by these salamander beings. These elementary beings can whisper things that the shepherd knows and tells him these things. And much of the recommendations, receipts, much of the recipes, whatever, recepta, the prescriptions, the formulations which come, which are in the mind of these shepherds, and such these qualities, are the result of what's whispered into them by these salamanders. It can absolutely be that a man is surrounded by such relationships as by fine spiritual beings, who equip him with such a knowledge of which our present clever intellectuals can never really dream about. In conclusion, I'd like to point to another phenomenon which can show you how certain things which today can be only have an abstract explanation really have arisen from a deep wisdom. I told you how in the Atlantean period, people, when they went out of their bodies, were able to live with the gods. Such gods which they revered as Zeus and Votan, these gods which came from another evolutionary development. These gods who never enter into a physical body. They do not touch the physical world. However, there are existing certain transitions. Man arose because his whole soul and spiritual being hardened itself to a physical body. With the human beings, you have the total group soul descended down to the physical plane. And the physical body of man has become a picture, an impression of the group soul. Just imagine a being of Zeus, as it were, just a little touches the physical plane, only permeates just a little way into the physical plane. Just as, for example, if you take a sphere, a ball, you immerse it in water, so that just only the lower part of the ball has become moistened with water. Similar way, certain beings in the Atlantean period were just touched by the physical world. The physical eyes do not see that which remains as a spiritual, as the astral etheric. Only the small portion of that which projects into the physical world is seen. Now, out of such perceptions, there arose the symbolism which you find in mythology. When Zeus has the eagle as a symbol, so that emanates from the fact that his eagle nature is the small summit where a being of the higher world touches the physical world. A great part of the bird world are cut off portions of such developing beings of the supersensible world. And just as with the ravens of Wotan, or the eagle of Zeus, so is it always everywhere where it goes back, symbolism goes back to occult facts. I really don't understand this last added. End the tape.